Okay. Let's get started. Welcome, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 13th, 2017. It is 9:30, and this is panel number 4155, the economic impacts of immigration. Very interesting topic. Thank you all for being here. I'm the moderator. My name is Lee Shanis. I run a nonprofit organization here in town called Intercambio. How many of you know Intercambio? All right. So we work with immigrants here and all throughout the country, teaching English and connecting people across cultures, creating friendships, and doing lots of important work. So if you're interested in that, I've got cards. But I'll let these guys do most of the talking today. It's going to be a really interesting panel. We have people with a variety of experience nationally and internationally. So let's get started. And when we get to the question part in this CWA session, we'll utilize both the CWA app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. So to ask a question in the app, simply select the session in the schedule, tap live Q&A, and then insert your question, and then I'll pick the ones I like best. All right. So let's get started. So we're going to start with Bill Marmon, who has been working with the European Institute. He's got a lot of interesting things to say about things happening around immigration internationally, not just in the U.S. So all the speakers' full bios are in your book, so I'm going to keep them short. And each person's going to talk for around 10 minutes or less, and we'll leave time for Q&A at the end. So please give a warm welcome to Bill Marmon.
Whoa, thank you very much. Can you hear this? Okay. Whoa, can you hear? Okay, good. Well, I'm delighted to be here. It's my first CWA, and I'm a CWA novice on this panel. I am not an economist, and so I'm going to talk about something I maybe know a little bit about, which is the political aspects of immigration and movement of peoples in Europe, where I've been watching the movement of peoples in Europe from my perch at the European Institute for some time now. And the free movement of people within Europe is one of the four freedoms that was one of the bases for the establishment of the common market, along with the free movement of goods, services, and capital. And it's one of the bases for the success of the EU and its economic success as well as its political success. So ironically, now you have the movement of refugees from the Middle East, which is presenting one of the great challenges to the EU, to its very existence and survival. And so it's sort of ironic that you have these two bookends of movements of peoples, one of the real successes of the EU, and one could be one of the elements of its destruction. Anyway, I tried to get into this subject a little bit, and looked at some of the stats, and it seems that the economists love immigration. The more you look at the stats, the better it looks. Particularly compelling are the stats from the U.S., which is a nation of immigrants, of course. Typical is Brookings Institute's survey that concludes, on average, immigrants raise the overall standard of living of American workers by boosting wages and lowering prices. Okay, what's wrong with that? And I was impressed by the literature on the importance of innovation to the growing economy. And the stats show that immigrants are more likely to file patents than Native Americans. And so, you know, at the beginning of this great refugee crisis, I was hopeful that this was going to be a really great opportunity for Europe to speak to some of its big problems. Europe has a low productivity rate, 1.5 children per woman over the EU population. aging population, falling population, and so this presented a fantastic opportunity for Europe when the immigrants started to pour in. Unfortunately, they were not able to handle it, and it has become an existential crisis. And it has become the source of this terrible toxic populism that's spreading throughout Europe. For instance, studies in the UK have shown that resentment over immigration was the strongest pull undergirding the Leave vote in the Brexit vote, which was last year, last June, and has recently been activated and is now in full swing to happen. And that could be, that's a terrible blow to the EU, and it's going to be, I think, a serious problem for the UK itself. And it may result in not only the UK leaving the EU, but it may even result in the dissolution of the UK itself, because Scotland and Northern Ireland are likely to try to detach themselves from the UK as a result of this. So, but what was the basis of this dissatisfaction, this resentment? Well, after 2004, the EU was enlarged to create the addition of 8 post-communist countries. And over 1 million Poles, Romanians, and Bulgarians, and other East Europeans relocated to the UK. And this has had not necessarily bad economic repercussions, but bad social repercussions, and has created this desire to be able to close their borders and regain control of immigration from within Europe, which of course is impossible, and that's the real stumbling block to the UK remaining in the EU. Now, the strength of Marine Le Pen, who is this right-wing populist in France, who is threatening to pull France out of the EU. That would be the end of the EU if France goes out. She may lose, but she's still going to be, even if she loses, her influence has been great. And she is also anti-immigrant. And in Germany, the real heart of the EU, Chancellor Angela Merkel is in a political fight of her life. She's up for re-election in the fall of this year, because of resentment and hostility to her open-door policy that in 2015 allowed the arrival of over 1 million Syrian refugees. So the challenge, I think, is how to harness the politically long-term benefits of immigration to overwhelm the short-term political disruption that it causes. Or else we're going to be next year, if something serious is not done about this, next year we're going to be having conferences on the economic impact of the dissolution of the EU. And that would be a serious matter, to say the least. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Up next, we have Pablo Better. He's from Ecuador, and he's worked with the Monetary Fund for Ecuador. He's worked with the Central Bank, the OPEC Fund, Universidades. He's worked with many different places, and I just learned, the father of one of my friends here.
So, pardon, what did you say?
I said you're the father of one of my friends here.
Oh, yes. You're a resident of Boulder.
So please welcome Pablo Better.
Thank you. I'm not a traditional economist, but I think that immigration has very positive economic consequences all over the world. I have been asked to talk about other countries, so I will concentrate on the Ecuadorian experience, my country's experience. I am a son of immigrants, refugees from Nazism. My mother came from Austria, my father came from Czechoslovakia in 1939 to Ecuador. They met there and raised a family. So there was a wave of Jewish immigration in the late 1930s and beginning of the 40s. And the impact of that immigration was extraordinary. In my notes, I talked about qualified, highly qualified immigrants and not so qualified immigrants. Most of the Jewish immigrants in Ecuador did not have a higher education degree. Some were in business in Europe before they came, and some simply came too young to have had an activity, economic activity in Europe. But they all strived. It's not, Ecuador was not a country of big immigration. There are about 5,000 Jews who immigrated to Ecuador, and the Jewish community today is less than 1,000 people. But the impact was extraordinary in several ways. They created industries that did not exist before in Ecuador. For example, wire industries, steel wire, aluminum wire industries. They created the modern textile industries, modern for the time. Food, they brought European food like salamis and hams and different types of cheeses and industrialized these things. So there was an immediate impact, a very great impact, that changed even the habits of the general population. This general population had been in contact with the Spanish conquistadores for 500 years before, but had not had any contact with Central Europeans. So little by little they were acquiring these customs. For example, something very interesting. Yogurt didn't exist in Ecuador. I remember my father would put in a glass of milk, a little bit of butter, put the glass outside of the window, and a couple of days later he had yogurt. He had, you see. Now there is a yogurt industry in Ecuador, a big one. Another family who went to Ambato. Did you visit Ambato when you were in Ecuador?
I don't think so. But
could not stand the mosquitoes. So they started producing anti-mosquito mesh in a textile machine, and this became a very big industry. Ideal Alambrek is one of the 10 biggest industries in Ecuador today. Electrical cables. One immigrant was an electrician, an electrical engineer, really, and was the first one to use tubing to put the electrical cables in construction. Before that, the cables were raw cables that you could see, and very dangerous, of course. These types of things, they introduced technology, they introduced habits, and they contributed to the development of the country. Later on, there was an Arab immigration to Ecuador, and commerce was stimulated, import and export of textiles. By the way, Arabs and Jews in Ecuador have a very good relationship, very close relationship. These are immigrant communities. They have that in common. And many went into partnerships to do these things. This is one aspect of it. So in general, immigrants have contributed to the development of the country. We can talk about other countries. In Argentina, there were hundreds of thousands of immigrants. There is literature on that. Gino Gerassi, an Argentinian writer of Italian descent, obviously, has published studies on the impact of immigrants in Argentina. Many more immigrants in Argentina than in Ecuador. And the impact was also much, much higher. So there is no doubt about that. But there is another experience where Ecuador leads other countries. And that is immigrants from Ecuador that due to the crisis, the economic, the financial crisis of the late 1990s and beginning of the first decade of the century, fled the country. They were refugees. And they came to the United States and they went to European countries. Some of them undocumented. They are excellent workers. The general opinion in Spain, in Italy, in the northern European countries, is that they are excellent workers. And they somehow, what workers in Ecuador do not do, which is work harder than they should, they do, they comply with their obligations, but nothing, often not more than that. Be creative, be entrepreneurs. The immigrants have become entrepreneurs in Europe and in the United States. There are Ecuadorian colonies in New York, in the Bronx maybe, mainly, New Jersey, and Chicago. Some of them big entrepreneurs, big industries, big commercial corporations. Little by little, they have been able to legalize their status in the United States. But even if they are illegally in the United States, that means undocumented, or in Europe, they have liberated their creativity and have had the initiative to create business, to create work for others as well, and to send enormous kinds of amounts of money back to Ecuador to their relatives, which has helped the Ecuadorian economy. By the way, Ecuador dollarized in the year 2000, so our currency is the dollar, the U.S. dollar. We don't print money, our own money. So we need the inflow of dollars in order to maintain the financial system. This has caused also a disruption of families, because usually undocumented immigrants don't emigrate with their families. They go by themselves, hoping to make a living and maybe bring their family later on to the country, either here or to Europe, or go back if they have saved enough. Well, this is not happening. Most of the immigrants stay, and homes are broken up. So you get children who are raised by grandparents or by practically single mothers, which is a problem inside of Ecuador. But financially, the families of immigrants are doing quite well because they receive the monies that the immigrants send usually. When one thinks of the United States, it's impossible not to think of Albert Einstein, who was an immigrant, and the highly qualified immigrants who have contributed to the advancement of science and technology in the United States, but also to the contribution that people who did not come as university professors or researchers or scientists, but who found in this country a fertile terrain to develop their own capacities. This is a country of opportunities, and the immigrants have, as most of you probably know because you are descendants of immigrants, most of you, they have been able to make a good living here. And I don't see how we can say that there is no contribution of immigrants. The political issue of the day, like in Europe, where refugees come, who need support, who cannot contribute immediately to the social security system or paying taxes. By the way, most undocumented immigrants in the United States pay taxes and pay the social security system as well. So they contribute to the growth of the country, economic growth of the country. But the issue with refugees is a different issue. This is a human rights issue. Even though most immigrants here and elsewhere came as refugees and not as immigrants, most immigrants. By the way, answering a question that you asked me before, the immigrants in Ecuador eventually got to be Ecuadorians. They were naturalized Ecuadorians. My parents were Ecuadorians, they had Ecuadorian passports. I was born in Ecuador, but an Ecuadorian, I have a right to get a passport, a Czechoslovakian passport, since my father was Czechoslovakian. I mean, a Slovakian passport. Now there are two countries. I haven't gotten it. But most refugees that came to Ecuador legalized their situation, and most of the ones that live there, which is one-fifth of what of the amount that arrived there at, originally, are Ecuadorians. I think all of them are Ecuadorians.
All right. Gracias, Pablo. All right, very excited to have our next panelist, Guy Benson. He's done a bunch of work with Fox News, and he's co-authored a book called End of Discussion, which is about how political correctness is crushing our ability to debate and have fun. He's done a lot of really interesting work, and excited to get his perspective on all this. So please welcome Guy Benson.
I feel like I'm being introduced to like a starting five in an NBA game. It's very exciting. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I think in terms of economic impacts of immigration in the United States, it's a pretty open and shut case, economically speaking. I'm not an economist, but I'm going to quote some. And when I was preparing for the panel today, I said, gosh, I wish someone would distill some of the relevant and salient facts into one letter. And wouldn't you know it, yesterday, 1,500 economists did exactly that, which, as if they knew that I needed their help. They sent an open letter. This is economists from across the political spectrum. So Austin Goolsbee, who is a former top advisor to President Obama, to Douglas Holtz Aiken, who worked under President George W. Bush, who's CBO director, a conservative guy who I really admire a lot. And Goolsbee, I've been on with. He's a Fox News regular, actually, former Obama advisor. So they're two of the signers of the many who have fixed their name to this letter, talking about the impacts economically of immigration in the United States. And it was addressed to the four relevant top leaders in Congress, and I suspect they also hope that maybe the president gets his hands on this letter. And so they go through, and I'm just going to quote them real quick. "We view the benefits of immigration as myriad," bullet point. "Immigration brings entrepreneurs who start new businesses that hire American workers." Bullet point. "Immigration brings young workers who help offset the large-scale retirement of baby boomers." Bullet point. "Immigration brings diverse skill sets that keep our workforce flexible, help companies grow, and increase the productivity of American workers." Bullet point. "Immigrants are far more likely to work in innovative job-creating fields such as science, technology, engineering, and math that create life-improving products and drive economic growth." So in their conclusion, they say immigration undoubtedly has economic costs as well, particularly for Americans in certain industries and Americans with lower levels of educational attainment. But the benefits of that immigration that immigration brings to society far outweigh their costs, and smart immigration policy could better maximize the benefits of immigration while reducing the costs. So I think that's pretty well stated, clearly stated. There's also a study in Harvard Business Review that was published last October that had a number of key findings, one of which was immigrants constitute 15% of the general U.S. workforce, but they account for around one quarter of U.S. entrepreneurs, which they define as the three initial earners in new businesses. So they are more likely than native-born Americans to start new businesses, and also file for patents, as we heard earlier. They write in Harvard Business Review, this is comparable to what we see in innovation and patent filings, where immigrants also account for about a quarter of U.S. investors. I think it's also probably worth pointing out, this has been documented for years, that legal immigrants in the United States are statistically less likely to commit crimes per capita than native-born Americans. So there's a great, I'm a big fan of Hamilton, the musical, and it's a little cliche, but it's just great, and you should love it too. And at one point, they've beaten the British in the Revolutionary War, and Hamilton and Lafayette turn to each other and they say, immigrants, we get the job done. And it's a great line, and in the United States, it's true. So as you can tell, I'm a pretty big fan of immigration. Now, I do think that when we are discussing immigration policy and what is sensible and what is not, I think the conflation of legal immigration and illegal immigration does a disservice to our discourse as we try to craft good policy. I think that it is not fair to cast as racist or nativist legitimate concerns about national sovereignty and border security and worries about whether or not we are really enforcing the laws that we have on our books. Compassion, we're a compassionate nation. We should be a compassionate nation. We should strive to continue to be one. You know, the message and the Statue of Liberty and all that, we should embrace that. But compassion cannot be the only metric that we consider as we look at our policies vis-a-vis immigration, refugees, and other questions along those lines. I know that there has been a sense among some people that it's unseemly for President Trump, for example, to highlight families who have lost loved ones, who have been killed by people who are here unlawfully. And, you know, I think that there is a line between highlighting that reality, which is real for those people and tragic for those people, and I think it's tough to tell a mother or a father, oh, well, you know, statistically, immigrants commit fewer crimes, and then, well, okay, but someone who was deported twice got back in here and murdered my daughter, that's cold comfort. I think it's also, there's a line, though, where we can cross into demagoguery, where we can make it seem like, oh, well, you know, these illegal immigrants are just sneaking into this country and murdering people. I mean, you know, or a bunch of rapists, I think, was someone said that once. I think that that's unhelpful, right, and creates a cloud of fear and resentment that makes it harder to make smart decisions about our policy making. I think there's a strong case to be made that in a number of respects our immigration system is broken. I think that that's part of the reason why the president had a resonant message on the campaign trail. People hearing a simple message like, we're going to build a wall, very beautiful. Big, beautiful door. But people see you know, the crisis, what was it, in 2015, of unaccompanied minors at the border, and they say, okay, when we hear our elites and our leaders say that the border is secure, that smells like BS to us, because it's clearly, in some key respects, not true. So I think that's part of why the president had the degree of support that he did among a lot of people when talking about these issues, sometimes in simplistic ways, but in ways that made sense to folks. I think when we're trying to figure out what our policy should be on immigrants and refugees, it's reasonable to ask certain questions. And this is just, I think, common sense. One, what are the values of the people coming into the country? Right? Someone who's coming into the United States from Mexico or Central America to work extremely hard and send remittances home to their family, it's going to have maybe different values than an unvetted Syrian refugee going into Germany, right? And are those values compatible with our small L liberal values as Americans? Also, what are the skills of immigrants? In terms of looking at different types of visas that we might be granting to people. And finally, what are the economic needs of the U.S. economy? Last thing I would say is something that I think is going to be a fascinating political question to watch is how President Trump decides to deal with, alter, or maintain, or reverse, I'm not sure, President Obama's executive order on the so-called Dreamers, right, which are illegal immigrants who were brought here as young children by their parents, who sort of had no control whatsoever over their immigration status. They're just kids, right? And so President Obama effectively granted something of a blanket amnesty for that subset of illegal immigrants, and I think that that's something that has pretty broad support across the political spectrum. In fact, at the time that the previous president did that, there was a bill that Senator Rubio from Florida was working on specifically targeted for the Dreamers and trying to create an equitable and fair resolution to their legal status in this country. There is still, I think, controversy about whether that was within President Obama's constitutional authority, given that it was not just enforcement discretion. There were also certain sort of proactive benefits that were given, and this was not an act of Congress. The president had indicated that perhaps he didn't have the authority, then he did it. He then expanded it to millions of adults, the parents of the Dreamers, in a separate action that he had said dozens of times he did not have the authority to do, very explicitly. Then he did it anyway. So I would not be surprised to see that second action. It's been held up in the courts, by the way, but if it were to go through, I think that would be probably reversed by Trump and the Republican Congress. But the first one, DACA, the Dreamers, there have been mixed signals from Trump, and if you read between the lines, I would not be surprised at all if he actually ends up keeping that in place, because I think that despite some of the caricatures of Trump, and he certainly invites caricatures of himself, he sort of is one, I do think that he is, he's not a completely soulless, cold-hearted person. And he met famously a few years ago with a group of Dreamers and changed his position on the issue. So I do think that there's at least a, I don't want to put a number on it, but a sizable chance that President Obama's DREAM Act will remain in place under President Trump. And it'll be very interesting to see how that decision is received by some who I think elected him not to do that. So stay tuned. That's going to be a very interesting, I think, political decision. But again, if I had to put my money on it, I think it's very foolish to make any bets about what President Trump will do ever. But if I were to put down $10, I would put seven of them that the DREAM Act, on some level, the executive order is going to remain intact. And so with that, I'll hand it over to an actual economist and look forward to your questions later. Thanks.
Thank you, guys. All right, up next we've got Pia Arrhenius. She has done a lot of writing around immigration. She's advised the Bush administration on labor, health, and immigration issues. She got a PhD in economics from the University of California, Los Angeles, and has done a lot of stuff with U.S. immigration policy. So please welcome Pia Arrhenius.
Thank you, Lee. It's a pleasure to be here. And although that said, I think my co-panelists have stolen my talking points. They've been very good at summarizing some of the economic benefits of immigration. So let me see where I can fill in. So certainly it's true, economists on net typically see that on net, immigration is a benefit to the economy. And that's seen from the perspective of natives. So it actually does increase the income that goes to natives when you have immigration. Why does that happen? Well, actually, by pushing down the cost of labor, it actually does two things. It lowers the prices of the services and goods that immigrants produce. So as consumers, we all benefit. And then producers, obviously employers, benefit from the cheaper cost of labor. On the negative side, though, however, if you are a worker, a U.S.-born worker, or perhaps an earlier immigrant, and you're competing directly with an immigrant in your field, well, then you're not going to benefit from more immigration. And I think we need to be upfront about that. The other question mark is, how does immigration affect taxpayers? And so the fiscal impact, we usually talk separately about the fiscal impact versus the economic impact, and, you know, I've done some work around the fiscal impact, and there is when you start looking separately at high-skilled immigration versus low-skilled immigration. But let's get back to that point in a minute. So immigrants come really for two reasons. In the U.S. case, at least, there's push and pull factors, I think, are a good summary mechanism for describing why people move. So conditions in the home country are important, and also conditions in the host country are important. We're blessed in some sense in the U.S. because so many of our immigrants go straight into the labor market. And that's key to the economic benefits of immigration. And that has implications for European immigration, which is a lot of humanitarian immigration, and which happens under a very different scenario. A lot of European countries have labor markets that are largely closed to immigrants, at least for the first period of time during which they're in the country. We don't have that problem in the United States. In the United States, we hire people, legal, illegal, whatever status, seamlessly integrated almost into the labor force. And the reason that's important is because that's where the gains from immigration come. So there's no gains to immigration if they're not in the labor force. Mm-hmm. I think that's just a really important point to emphasize. So they have to be able to join the labor force. And the other thing that has to happen is prices and wages need to adjust. In the U.S., typically we don't have a situation where that doesn't happen. But you can imagine scenarios, highly regulated economies or, where wages are regulated and prices are regulated, that you won't have prices and wages adjusting. If you don't have that, you won't realize the gains to immigration. Again, these are some of the struggles that are more closer to the European case than the U.S. case. In the long run, and we never say as economists what the long run is, it's true. But the long run is really important because in the long run, immigration, because it lowers the cost of labor, it stimulates business investment. And when your business investment, what economists call capital inflows, that shifts out the demand for labor and that restores the wages. So this is really important. So if you talk to an economist who's anti-immigration, he'll say, in the long run, what did Keynes say? We're all dead, so it doesn't matter. If you talk to a pro-immigrant economist, they'll say, the long run already happened. Employers in the U.S. are already making those business investments in anticipation of hiring immigrants. So that's really where the debate can come down to what is, you know, how long is the long run. But anyway, so business investment is key to integrating immigrants and restoring wages. All the other things that my co-panelists mentioned are also true. Immigrants are more innovative. They're more innovative, file for more patents, because they're more likely to be in STEM fields. Science, technology, engineering, and math, because those STEM fields are very active in research, that's why immigrants patent more than U.S.-born workers. But the nice thing about the patenting rates of immigrants, they look like they spill over onto natives. So if you're native scientists working with immigrant scientists, then your patenting rates also increase. So there's positive spillovers there in innovation. And innovation is really the most important aspect of economic growth, because that's what raises productivity, and higher productivity is what raises living standards in the long run. So that's really, truly important. So in the work I've done on policy, I've really, really, really emphasized high-skilled immigration and also employment-based immigration for these two reasons. It has to be employment-based because that's where the gains to immigration come from. That's not saying that family-based immigrants don't work. They surely work. But you can have a little bit more employment-based immigration than we do in the United States because we have fairly little, actually, especially if you compare it to, like, Canada, where the overwhelming majority of their immigration is employment-based. So high-skilled immigration is really important. It's also true that immigrants are more entrepreneurial. They start more businesses. However, the flip side is their businesses are also more likely to fail. You need to look, and that's probably because they have less access to capital, to banks and credit and that type of thing. On the low-skilled end, the two benefits of immigration that people sometimes forget to talk about is, first of all, the low-skilled immigrants. In fact, one of the economics professors here at CU Boulder, Brian Cadena, actually published a very influential paper on this where he showed that Mexican immigrants were very key in the Great Recession because they actually moved from declining areas to growing areas. And this is more important than it might sound because this is actually what smooths out differences in regions between the utilization of labor. So you don't want to have very high unemployment regions and very low unemployment regions. That's sort of an economic inefficiency. So immigrants have been proven to be more mobile than native workers. And so that's another important role that they fill. They kind of grease the engine of the labor market by moving to growing areas. And lastly, although, you know, economists try to stay away from this, you know, these low-skilled immigrants, they tend to work in jobs that Americans don't like to work in. And so when you say that to another economist, they'll say, but if you didn't have the immigration, the wages would rise and the natives would take that job. Well, I look at my 19-year-old son and I say, at what price would you pick lettuce under hot sun, you know, in the California desert? You know, not at, I don't know, not at any price that under which that lettuce operation would be sustainable in the United States. So basically, if wages were to rise in order for American workers to take those jobs, then we wouldn't have that industry in the United States. So you have to take that into consideration. We would simply import all the tomatoes and the nuts and the lettuce and so forth. So, So in the end, there's net economic benefits to immigration. They're very, very large in terms of high-skilled immigration. In the case of low-skilled immigration, they're slightly smaller, and the big reason for that is because the fiscal impact of low-skilled immigration, what they contribute in taxes versus what they use up in publicly provided services, typically public education, you know, tends to be a net negative. So that's sort of the difficult issue for policymakers.
All right. Thank you, Pia. Let's give a hand to all of our panelists. All right. We got a lot of good questions here. There's a couple questions here about kind of immigration reform in general. And so I'm going to consolidate a couple of those questions into this. So there's a lot of talk, I think, about sanctuary cities and DACA and DAPA and a lot of temporary stuff. What if a larger scale reform happened? So basically what we see is kind of, I'll summarize it into three major proposals for immigration reform on the national level. One is path to citizenship. The other extreme is deport everybody. And then somewhere in the middle is maybe path to legal status, kind of like a green card thing, but not a path to citizenship. How would those impact the economy? Because if you have people gain status, that impacts the Social Security system, that impacts home buying, that impacts people being a part of the formal economy more. Love to get some thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, as the novice here, let me say that I also agree with Guy that Hamilton is a fantastic musical. And but I think that line he quoted could be amended to undocumented, we get it done also. And the construction industry employs 1.1 million undocumented workers. And the leisure and hospitality services employ 1.3 million undocumented workers. Business services, 990,000. Manufacturing, 890,000. Wholesale and retail, 850,000. Education and health, 510,000. Agriculture, 350,000. So, I wonder, I hate to put Guy on the spot, but he said he would volunteer to defend the Trump proposal, some of the Trump proposals, and I wonder if he does defend the proposal to for wholesale deportation of undocumented.
Well, that's not the policy that they're pursuing, though. And you have to differentiate between the president's rhetoric on the campaign trail and what he's actually doing now that he's been elected. And he's also said a lot of different things. over the course of the campaign even. So, you know, there was the deportation force and that whole freak out, and then there was the, well, maybe not, we're going to have the wall, but there's going to be the door, and it's going to be beautiful, and believe me, it's, so I'm trying to keep track of what he's actually doing, and what he's actually doing in some ways is continuing, maybe in a more robust way, but he's continuing the previous president's policy, which was to focus, at least initially, on deportations of people who are here illegally and then who have also committed additional crimes. Now, I think one of the big differences is, you know, the crimes that the Obama administration were prioritizing for deportation were more serious violent crimes, and I think the Trump administration has added to the list, including sort of fraud and fiscal crimes and lower level felonies and misdemeanors. But still, nonetheless, the prioritization is not just, you know, blanket deportations across the board, but rather focusing on people who violated our immigration laws in the first place getting here and then violated another law. That is, I think, to me, a completely reasonable policy and one that's going to have a lot of support among the American people. So as far as that goes for now, I think that's completely defensible, and I'm happy to do so.
Can I?
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
I think we have to make a few distinctions. I think nobody is going to support illegal immigration. Every country has the right to establish its laws and control the immigration. That is one aspect. The refugee status is a legal status. So when we talk about refugees, we're not talking about illegal immigrants. They are legal wherever they go, wherever they ask for refuge. But the United States is facing facts. People who came illegally 15 years ago, 12 years ago, 20 years ago, who made a living in the United States, who have children in the United States, they pay taxes, they are affiliated to the Social Security system, they report to immigration officials who gave them a working permit, but they don't have a legal status as immigrants. They are being deported. And their children, underage children, under 18 years old, stay in the United States. They divide the families. A Mexican lady is being deported these days. She was supposed to be deported on Tuesday. And her 12-year-old daughter doesn't want to go to Mexico. She has never been in Mexico. She doesn't speak Spanish well. And her friends are here. The school is here. And her little brothers, I think she has two brothers, don't want to go to Mexico either. So the family is going to be divided. This is a human rights situation. This has already transcended the legality or illegality of their immigration. I think criminals should not be allowed in the country. I think they should be deported. But I don't know whether minor felons. The minor felony, the original one, is to have come illegally. Who is to judge how should the felon be treated? I don't want to go into American politics, but...
go ahead.
I think you understand what I mean. So... we have to distinguish between or among different circumstances in which the immigrants live. I don't think the government is going to deport 11 million illegal immigrants. I don't think President Trump is going to do that. I agree with you. The policies are going to be different. There is an institutional framework in the United States. There is a political culture in the United States, which is greater than any president or any public official. My point is, we have to be careful when we use terms. A person that has been here 10, 12, 15, or 20 years has lived as an immigrant, has complied with the laws, has contributed to society through taxes and his or her work, is not in the same situation as a person who is coming from the border and going through the wall and is caught in the border. He's an illegal immigrant who probably has to go back to his country. Any country will deport that guy. But the person who has been here for years and has made a contribution should be treated differently. And the refugee policy, which is central to the European situation, is a different situation because that gives legal status to people who are persecuted somehow politically, and they want to get refuge in a country where they can live safely at least.
Pia?
So while I'm sympathetic to Pablo's arguments, you don't have to be compassionate to advocate for amnesty. Actually, the economics are pretty straightforward around the benefits of letting people stay that have been here for a long time. Because if you think of the economic impact that we talked about earlier, that has really already been realized. So that labor market impact is realized when the immigrants first come in, and then the economy is sort of adjust to the presence of the new immigrant, and then once you've adjusted to this new equilibrium, if you will, then it really doesn't make any sense to kick that person out. Mm-hmm. And then we know there's all these other benefits to citizenship, not just for parents but also for children. And so you can imagine lots of favorable outcomes come from a more permanent legal status. So, and then of course there's all these negative consequences, economic consequences of deporting people that have settled here, that have jobs here, that have mortgages here, that have credit cards here. If you think about all the knock-on effects of deporting people that are actually settled here that are obviously not criminal in any other capacity. And then of course if you have some other temporary, more transitory legal status, you're not going to get all the benefits that you might get from somebody who's permanently here in a citizenship, under U.S. citizenship. Now that said, the downside of a citizenship, a granting citizenship, a blanket citizenship, is what happens to the expectations of immigrants that are not yet immigrants. So what's going to happen to the probability of migrating to the United States if you grant amnesty or citizenship to everyone that's here now? So that might encourage them to come as well. So I think that in terms of the economic models, that's really where the rub is. So how do you address that? So back to Lee's question, I think just the economics makes sense around granting citizenship. However, you'd have to reform the system as you do that. So one thing would be to impose mandatory E-Verify, which is forcing employers to use the federal E-Verify system to electronically verify that the workers they hire are authorized to work. So this is a very effective system that will actually dry up the jobs magnet and that would prevent further undocumented immigration if you do an amnesty. And then you might want to reform our family-based immigration system because it's the immigrants that benefit the most from the family-based immigration system, and it's actually a very generous immigration system. And given that immigrants are already the biggest beneficiaries of immigration, I think you could do that, and that will also, contain some of the spillover effects of granting citizenship to the 11 million.
Because I would just add that the border crisis with the unaccompanied minors a couple of years ago, the Border Patrol was telling lawmakers that, you know, what we heard over and over again was, this was right around the time that President Obama was talking about the Dreamer executive order, and that, you know, rumors about that filtered down into Mexico, Central America, and a lot of parents, and again, you know, if you're a parent, and you want something better for your kid, you can't really blame them. But they're sending their children saying, okay, there's going to be this amnesty for minors. Let's get my kid up there because I want them to have a better life. There are incentives, right, in U.S. policy, and it's something that we need to keep in mind. And that also goes to, you know, it's a tricky, thorny issue with the breaking up of families. Because no one wants to look at a family and say, you guys get out, you guys were born here, so you stay. Parents are gone, the kids are here, or they have to go with their parents to a life they never knew before. But, you know, if we're going to every single time make the case about, you know, ripping apart families, you sort of incentivize people to bring their kids, and then they'll never get deported because of that humanitarian question. So it's something we have to be careful about. Last point on the political solution to this, and we might come back to it. There's a lot of discussion on path to citizenship versus path to legal status. I know there's concern among many conservatives, Republican voters, that just sort of doing a blanket amnesty with citizenship then creates a whole new pool of voters immediately. And so there are some folks who say, you know, a path to legal citizenship, legal status rather, as opposed to citizenship, might be a compromise. And there's also the question of the people who've been sitting in line for a long time, doing it the right way. There's a fairness question here, saying, oh, well, you know, this is enough of a problem with enough millions of people. We're just going to grant citizenship or legal status to a bunch of you. And sorry, folks who've been trying to do it the right way for years, in many cases, tough luck. That's another incentive question that we have to really think through.
Yeah, go ahead.
Very, very short thing. The exceptions are exceptions. I think we're talking about the general situation. And I would like to add to Pia's comments one thing. If we look at the long run, before we all die, there will be second and third generation Americans born from immigrants, who will have an impact in the not only in the economy, in the society, in the culture. So we can look at the long run and their contribution. You know, the pilgrims were not regular immigrants. They came illegally here.
Yeah, I just wanted to echo what Guy said. It's a real interesting issue, the concept of a path to legal status versus a path to citizenship. And my quick recommendation is we should ask also the undocumented immigrants what they think of that, because they're not often a strong voice with that. It's often the far left and the far right, but giving those folks a voice. Interesting question here. How do undocumented immigrants pay taxes if they don't have a Social Security number? Very common area that folks don't know a lot about, and not just sales tax, but filing taxes and paying into Social Security's taxes. So does anyone want to feel that? How do people without documents pay taxes?
So there's taxes everywhere. I'm sure you know. So it could be a driver's license fee or an income tax or a state tax or a federal tax, property tax. So undocumented immigrants, just even if they don't file a federal income tax return, will pay all these other taxes, property tax through their rent, sales tax when they purchase something, and so on and so on. But if the question is how do they pay federal income tax, well, actually, so what they do is that they file under a false Social Security number or a made-up number, or they can file under an employer, what's it called again?
ITIN.
An ITIN, an individual taxpayer ID number. Right. Yeah. So the United States is great in that regard. And again, I compare to Europe because we've really facilitated illegal immigration because we haven't. We've let employers hire undocumented immigrants, and we've let them file taxes. And the way we let them file taxes is giving them these ITINs. And nobody will come for you. You can apply for an ITIN, and nobody will come look for you. Mm-hmm. And you can file a tax return, even though you're not legally in this country. And they've been doing that. And why do they do that? Well, because actually, when one day, if we're going to regularize status of undocumented immigrants, we're going to ask for these tax returns. If you have one, it's really going to be in your favor. And so there's that expectation that's there. And so they, so it's surprising how many undocumented immigrants file taxes, but they do, and we have, where does the money go in the Social Security Fund? Well, it goes into something, and help me, it's, there's a special fund that is for people who are contributing money that we don't know really who they are. So, I forget the name right now, it'll come to me. But under the Social Security Fund, it has over $1.5 trillion worth of earnings in it. And if you look, it's $1.5 trillion. When I was in Washington, you know, 10 years ago, it was only, I think, $650 billion. Now it's over $1 trillion. So these are the contributions to Social Security from undocumented immigrants. And, you know, if they do legalize and get a Social Security number, if they saved all their W-2s, they can move those earnings into their new Social Security number, and they can get Social Security eventually. But that, you know, is... depends on whether they save the W-2s and they become citizens eventually. And so most of that money is probably lost to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To them, yeah. I mean, we've used it up already. Yeah. It's spent.
Yeah. This question here is from a student. There's a couple questions around this topic of undocumented workers kind of getting exploited, being paid less, not being provided with benefits, and really the economic impacts of that. And
lower wages.
Bill, I don't know if you...
No, I think Pia...
Pia can take that one.
So there's this certainly happens, that undocumented immigrants... particularly when they're newly arrived and they lack networks and resources and they don't know where to turn to for help, that, you know, there is the case of labor exploitation, especially when they're paid in cash. You know, sometimes they're not paid at the end of the day, or, you know, they're promised, you know, a lower cash rate in exchange for lunch or transportation and things like that, which really under, you know, most state and federal employment law, those are not legal. But in general, again, my argument has always been that we've created an economy around illegal immigration that allows it to continue. And so, and because we've really not cracked down for the most part on employers that hire undocumented immigrants, then there's been an incentive for them to treat them as if they didn't know they were undocumented. Continue.
Cue the disco lights.
You're right.
Blackout.
So I would say that based on the evidence, the research that we've done, I mean, it's fairly rare for them to be underpaid. Typically, employers like to pretend like they don't know they're undocumented and treat them like other low-skilled workers.
All right. Thank you. And then there's a couple other questions here about, we talked a lot about the economic benefits, but the question is, are there cases where immigration is not economically beneficial for the host country? And then there's two other questions that bring up, you know, I've been in this, a teacher for 40 years, and I saw the educational system decline because of an influx of immigrants. Another question is about kind of the environmental impact of just population growth in general around this. So I don't know if anyone has thoughts, and that can apply to Europe as well.
Well, in Europe, certainly, as has been pointed out, refugees are very—they don't pay taxes for a long time, sometimes as much as a generation. In fact, I saw some studies saying that it's 20 years in Germany before refugees are expected to be sort of paying their way. So it is a cost, but you know, we're talking long term here, and. And their children are likely to be paying taxes earlier than that. And they may be filing patents earlier than that and making these other benefits. Another economic cost to refugees in Europe. Now, Europeans are paying $2 billion a year to Turkey to house refugees. And that's a very improbable situation, unstable situation, and costly, and there's the hope that these refugees will go home someday, although I think that experience has shown that refugees, some refugees do go home, but a lot do not. And so we're talking, when we're talking the benefits of immigration, of refugees, it's certainly a longer payback period.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to point out, and this was at least glanced upon in the letter that I read from these economists, that, you know, there are downsides to immigration as well. You know, you shouldn't pretend otherwise. It's not all a bright picture. There are trade-offs. I think the argument that's made economically is that net-net, it's a positive in the aggregate, but that doesn't mean that there aren't Americans, for example, who are hurt, especially in certain industries. And then to Pia's point about the fiscal questions surrounding illegal immigration in particular, low-skilled.
Legal is more expensive, actually.
Interesting, yeah. I mean, that's where you start looking at tax dollars being spent, resources, like to the point of the teacher, ESL classes and ESL resources going towards English second language as opposed to potentially other priorities within the schools. When we talk about these things, you know, we shouldn't pretend that some of these trade-offs and challenges don't exist as well, because they do.
I'm going to take issue with this. Americans have to be convinced that education without a second language is not a good quality education. So you need another language. You are required to get a PhD, you need two foreign languages, I think. And in some universities, to complete your undergraduate studies, you need one foreign language. So investing resources in teaching another language is very important. It's part of the quality of education. And on the question of refugees, I insist, they are not illegal immigrants. They are temporary legal as long as the refugee status is respected in every country. We cannot evaluate the question of refugees in terms of costs and benefits, economically, I mean. To accept refugees is not an economic question. It is a human rights question. Peoples who are free, who can live in liberty, in a peaceful country, in a law-abiding country, have an obligation towards those who are not that fortunate. And in extreme cases like Syria, I'm not talking about the Latin American immigrants who come illegally to the United States. I'm talking about Syria. I'm talking about people who live in extreme situations and their lives are in danger. This is not an economic issue.
Okay, Pablo, I agree with you, absolutely. But I do want to make an important distinction between refugees and asylum seekers. Mm. So refugees usually come already pre-approved into the country. So the U.S., I don't know how many we take, maybe we've been taking about 70,000 a year.
Right.
We're now planning to take far fewer under this administration. But so refugees is one thing, and I totally agree with Pablo. But in the European case, for example, the great majority of those migrants are asylum seekers. And when they apply for asylum, far less than 50% are approved for asylum. So there's a lot of people along for the ride. So in with the Syrians that have suffered greatly are other peoples from Afghanistan, from Uzbekistan, from other countries, you know, which really are not going to qualify for asylum in most cases. Their applications get denied, and then it becomes very difficult and expensive to find and deport them.
That's true. I agree with
and,
you.
And just to clarify the point about ESL, I'm an advocate of teaching foreign languages. I speak a little bit of Spanish thanks to my public education and then continued in college as well. I'm all for that. When I'm talking about ESL resources, I'm not poo-pooing that at all. I'm saying the degree of dollars that have to go into teaching kids who are here who don't speak English how to speak English so they can then be instructed in other classes and other disciplines, which is a separate question. And as for refugees and asylum seekers, part of the reason I think Bill mentioned the political trouble that Angela Merkel finds herself in, or the pickle that she's in a little bit. It's not because, you know, Germans woke up one day and said, oh my gosh, we hate the chancellor. I mean, she's been extremely popular for years and years now across a wide ideological spectrum. Some of these asylum seekers and refugees, you know, are not the, you know, the child or the woman who is fleeing the ravages of ISIS and the Assad regime in Syria. There are, you know, military-aged single men showing up, and there have been really horrible social examples of widespread sexual assaults and other things. There are responsibilities of the host government to make sure that they are also protecting the rights, lives, and safety of their own citizens, right? So, and I don't think it's wrong to point that out, and that's a big component of, I think, her political struggles, and part of the reason why a Le Pen in France has gained as much currency and traction as she had, because some of the locals are saying, well, hang on, what about us? What about our safety? What about our communities?
Only the British and the French are under
America. Yeah, exactly.
So, kind of a question tied into that, maybe for Bill, is where is a model for a good immigration system? Is there one? The quick answer might just be no.
Well, I don't know.
There is one.
I know that Sweden has done a very excellent job on its refugee situation.
Bill, that's the wrong one.
Australia, Canada.
Well, U.S., for instance.
U.S.?
I mean, U.S., of course, is the poster child for immigration. And the key thing is, of course, is incorporation and getting people into the workforce. But I think that Sweden, until recently, has been thought to have done an excellent job with the refugee process, and without any necessarily terrible political consequences. They've done a great job on language training, and that's one of the things that seems to be missing in the United States right now. I mean, my wife and I are involved in our church with a refugee family from Afghanistan, and you know, very little language training is available in the programs that they get. In fact, they're depending on the church members to do it on a volunteer basis. So, I don't know. Somebody else may know a better example of a success story.
Go ahead, Pia.
Oh well, I actually like where you ended up with the U.S. But the thing is that usually experts don't point to the U.S. as having a great immigration system because so much of our immigration has been undocumented, so they see that as a failure. But you can say, well, that's sort of an economic success story because we've all benefited from it to a large extent. But actually, the experts always point to Canada as having the best immigration policy, not because they've had one policy through the ages, but because they changed their policy as they needed to change. So, and as things fail, they fix them and they move forward and they try something else. And that's what I like the most about the Canadian system. Also, they have an employment-based system, the system that was initially based on education levels. When they saw that that didn't work that well, because a lot of their high-skilled immigrants actually ended up driving taxis in Toronto, then they decided, well, maybe we should bring employers into the equation and ask employers who do they want to bring into the country. Then they gave a lot more weight to employment. So if you had an offer of employment as well as education, then you were prioritized for a visa. So the Canadians have had a very flexible, employment-based, economic-focused immigration policy, which I think has served them well.
Yeah, and I'd be careful about pointing to some of the Scandinavian examples, because they took a lot of people in very quickly. And then I know in Norway and a few of the other Scandinavian countries, the government has had to put out leaflets and training for military-age men not to rape. It's like, you know, we don't do that here. There's enough of a problem. And also some of these countries are actually trying to pay refugees to leave. And there are communities that are extremely insular where there's very little assimilation happening, where the authorities are concerned about exerting sovereignty in those places. And there was just an unfortunate incident in Sweden last week, which is not to say one incident is an indictment of an entire country's policy, but I think we're starting to see some of the fracturing in places like Sweden under the weight of this over the course of a number of years.
Thank you. I just looked at the time, and we're done. So can we give a big thank you to our panelists?